Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 89, section 6, which is old single column page 980. I think all we have to do to step in where we left off is just remember the latter part of what we read last week, they were giving us a series, you know, there's 7 bullet points there, that enumerated list. They were giving us a series of changes in the moray systems of peoples that was leading to an evolution away from cannibalism. And remember, that was essentially ubiquitous. Not everyone was starting with cannibalism. And as cannibalism was being limited and limited and limited, what sort of finally made it go away is the concept of human sacrifice. Because recall that fundamentally what the situation there is, you finally got it to the point that that you're thinking basically of a human in such fetishistic terms that no human can be allowed to eat such sacredness, only, the gods. On the one hand, right, there you can feel something positive there, that at least humans are starting to get a little bit more self-respect. They're starting to have a little bit higher, concept that they identify with themselves, no matter how superstitious or objectively false it might be. Nonetheless, there's a positive advancement there.
They wouldn't eat it if it wasn't organic.
Yeah, right. It's the same way that we throw out the word organic because to indicate its sacredness, right. That kind of thinking is being identified with humans a little bit. Remember, it started out, you had this, only the spirit land stuff was, had any, let's just say divinity to it, right? Okay, not to quibble with the word, but, any believed fanciness to it, profundity to it. And, humans were just dirt. They were just the scum of the earth. I mean, and the gods knew it, and that's why we were constantly abused. Yeah, we deserved it. But of course, one of the things that kind of fed into I'm just dirt is remember they still kind of had an evolutionary concept of starting with very simple stuff and going to fancier stuff, and so it led to a kind of a natural humility that was overplayed. Okay, there's humble and then there's, just ridiculous. You don't want to take humility to the point of being devoid of self-respect. But anyway, you have all of these interesting forces going on that that finally get it so that, you've got people, except for the very, very primitive tribes that weren't moving anywhere, away from cannibalism. But in many ways, you now have a phenomenon that's, kind of just as horrendous and, in a sense, human sacrifice. And that didn't have as much of a kind of a genetic bias against it as cannibalism did. It was a lot easier to convince the better genetic peoples to go for human sacrifice. So you actually start to get something that's even more widespread than cannibalism ever was. I mean, You know, the relatively pure Adamites, say, you know, back in the day, you know, didn't have any tendency to be cannibalistic. But you combine, like I said, that evolutionary sense that humans are a pinnacle of animal fanciness with now this false, you know, fetishistic, like, sacredness that you put inside of a human, and you know, you end up with something that's quite compelling. Yeah, it's got all kinds of interesting, intriguing, if you will, spiritual candy to it. Like I so often say, you know, it's seductive. So that's where we want to talk about now is what happens with that concept of human sacrifice and then how, of course, that's going to get modified and tempered, and some of the interesting things that it leads to, once the literalness of human sacrifice disappears. Okay, so let's just jump in and see what they have to say.
6. Evolution of human sacrifice. Human sacrifice was an indirect result of cannibalism, as well as its cure. Providing spirit escorts to the spirit world also led to the lessening of man-eating, as it was never the custom to eat these death sacrifices. No race has been entirely free from the practice of human sacrifice in some form and at some time, even though the Andonite, Naudite, and Adamites were the least addicted to cannibalism.
Okay, so the latter part there I already sort of said in the preface. Like I said, no race was entirely free. It's a very seductive concept. Notice they mentioned there's another issue that's helping out, again, another mode of the human is too sacred to eat, you don't want to disrupt this physics of all these all these people that you sacrifice that are going to be helpers for the fancy guy that died. So you're providing spirit escorts, right, as they're saying there, to the spirit world also led to that. It's just once you get that taboo, you know, that you're not allowed to eat that, only the gods are allowed to eat that. I mean, humans have a crude, synthetic, logical sense. You know, it'll spread out, and they'll make it more and more consistent. You know, and that's what they're pointing out. You know, it's like, oh well, wait a minute. You know, that's to be consistent. I can't eat them either. And see, so even though it's this very crude sort of what you're dealing with literally, it's all giving more raw material. Pardon the pun, for our reflective thinking to try to be ever more consistent and not be satisfied with as much arbitrariness. Remember, they mentioned that last time. You know, you'd have two things kind of side by side in the culture that are just complete opposites conceptually. And no one is noticing it. No one is bothered by it. But that lessens with time. Humans naturally progress, and they get ever more consistent, even if it's silliness that they're consistent about, or superstitiousness that they're consistent about. It's a step to be consistent. It means eventually there can be a spiritual awakening. You know, in a normal world, eventually you'll have something that a magisterial son can come to and work with, right? Until the humans are trying to be consistent, I mean, you know, there's no point in a magisterial son showing up, right? Because he's going to be talking at the wall. No one is going to get what he's trying to foster. All right. Let's keep going.
Human sacrifice has been virtually universal. It persisted in the religious customs of the Chinese, Hindus, Egyptians, Hebrews, Mesopotamians, Greeks, Romans, and many other peoples. even on to recent times among the backward African and Australian tribes. The later American Indians had a civilization emerging from cannibalism and therefore steeped in human sacrifice, especially in Central and South America. The Chaldeans were among the first to abandon the sacrificing of humans for ordinary occasions, substituting therefore animals. About 2,000 years ago, a tender-hearted Japanese emperor introduced clay images to take the place of human sacrifices, but it was less than 1,000 years ago that these sacrifices died out in Northern Europe. Among certain backward tribes, human sacrifice is still carried on by volunteers, a sort of religious or ritual suicide. A shaman once ordered the sacrifice of a much-respected old man of a certain tribe. The people revolted. They refused to obey. Whereupon the old man had his own son dispatch him. The ancients really believed in this custom.
Yeah, so it just, when it's the norm and, you know, and a very, very traditionalized, you know, established norm, they just don't have any sort of hesitancy about it. Like it's hard for us to imagine not having. It's just very matter of fact and very devout, right? To follow, you know, highest honor. You know, I mean, it would bring total dishonor upon his whole family for generations. You know. Uncountable if he didn't, you know, sacrifice himself. You know, is the way he's thinking. There's no way he would curse his family like that. Okay, so again, it starts out here in this paragraph, like I said, virtually universal. You know, you name the fancy civilization, you know, whether it's Indus Valley or the, you know, whomever. Okay, they all had human sacrifice. Okay, and you don't want to imagine that somehow in one of these, you know, megalithic ruins, cultures that we dig up somewhere, that it was a mystical Atlantean place, you know, where they didn't have human sacrifice. There wasn't any such place. There's no golden, you know, civilization in the past. You know, except for, right, and that's, of course, how the golden stuff gets started, you know, except for what Adam and Eve are up to, especially in the first garden. And, you know, people don't really remember back to the, you know, Dalmatia. But, you know, the mythology that stems from the first garden, more so than the second garden, and, you know, certainly leads to some of these concepts of a golden age and that sort of stuff. But, you know, that non-evolutionary fact aside, right, of the first garden.
Although you could say Adam sacrificed himself.
Right, of course. And see, and that's why, I'm glad you brought that up. Let me just pause for a second, a little aside. You know, for those of you on the webinar, he said, but Adam sacrificed himself, did he not? Notice that you used that word sacrifice. Right? You used it in that metaphoric sense. The fact that we still use that word sacrifice, you'll say, I mean, how do you describe kindness? Well, I guess I have to say mutual self-sacrifice. I mean, we really don't have any other way of sort of thinking about that issue except to use that word. And that's, again, why human sacrifice was virtually universal. I mean, the sacrifice concept is, you know, even when you abstract it, you know, and stuff, and take it away from any literalness, it's a very powerful, compelling concept, right? Of course I would sacrifice for my family. I mean, I would be immoral if I didn't, you say to yourself, right? Now, one could argue that, you know, we could come up with a new word for that, that didn't have the baggage of literal sacrifice tied to it. Okay. But nonetheless,
it would lack its historic meaning.
Right. That's the difficulty. In this life perforce we serve two masters, you know. it's going to be a long, 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 long time until humans don't have to speak in a way that really gives support to our history, you know, where we just completely see ourselves as a people of the future and really the past is kind of irrelevant. I mean, that's, okay, we way deep in light and life, sure. I mean, people might be, you know, so incredibly oriented like that, but yeah, not at any time soon. We kind of, you know, we need to feel a sense of connection and validation of our past, right?
Well, the whole atonement doctrine is based on God sacrificing His only Son for for our sin. I mean, that whole concept you're talking about is really, it's totally ingrained in our.
Yes, and of course that's why we're building up to atonement here. That's why we're talking about sacrifice. Okay, now some of the details in there. You know, notice how they make a point of reminding you that stuff in Central and South America, you know, you could have so recently such intense human sacrifice there because those people were so recently making the transition from cannibalism to human sacrifice. So, you know, they hadn't gone to more refined concepts of sacrifice. They were sort of just in the immediate coarseness of sacrifice post-cannibalism. And, you know, don't forget how much older things are in other parts of the world, right? And then when they say that the Chaldeans were among the first to abandon the sacrificing of humans for ordinary occasions, substituting therefore animals, is there a particular individual who was born in Chaldea that you're familiar with the story about who... You know, his story models the transition from human sacrifice to animal sacrifice. Not Moses.
Abraham.
Right? Born in Chaldea. Mm-hmm. Right? Right. That's why, you know, what they're hinting at between the lines there of that statement. You know, that's why that's in the Bible at such an early stage.
Where's Chaldea today, what do they call it?
That's with Samaria, southern Mesopotamia. Yeah, it's, you know, the Chaldeans were the residual cultural differential in southern Mesopotamia, predicated on the literal genetic differential of the Sumerian Nadites there in more ancient times. You know, all the way into the times of Jesus, you still had that differential in Mesopotamia, where in the southernmost region, you had a source of more refined cultural sensibility. All right, so the story of, you know, Abraham is going to sacrifice Isaac, and God says, no, sacrifice this ram instead. That's what they're alluding to. That's immortalizing that transition from human sacrifice to animal substitution. Remember, we have all these substitution things, like they hinted that way back, you know, including the Japanese emperor substituting clay images. And then that final statement is reminding you of this tension. You can begin to have an evolution of mentality that, you know, that's very crude. I think we're more advanced people than that. We shouldn't be sacrificing humans. But those who really feel an identification with tradition, you know, they will overrule the thoroughly modern Millies, right? It's like, no. You know, we need to honor the past, right? You know, you often hear that honor the past expression. So the old man is, you know, will have his son who's, you know, obeys him, dutiful to him, dispatch him if no one else will allow it. And then when they say, you know, less than 1,000 years ago, these sacrifices died out in Northern Europe, Okay, who's doing the sacrifices there, the human sacrifices? Starts with a V. The Vikings, of course. All right? And it's that northern white race, you know, the residual of that northern white race. It's, it was definitely starting to die out during Viking times, but it wasn't totally, you know, if they felt that they needed some serious mojo, you know, to deal with the situation, they were going to, you know, bring human sacrifice into play again to try to, get a better advantage over their enemies or whatever. Yeah, so, yeah. So even seeing that, and they throw that in just to remind you, okay, all those, you know, the most of the Andite blood went to Northern Europe. You had the Northern White race. Okay, you know, wouldn't that be the last place that you would think of there would be human sacrifice because of that better genetics? No. Cannibalism, okay, maybe not. Okay, but human sacrifice was very, very compelling concept. You know, when you wanted to bring in the most powerful, quote-unquote, spiritual energies to bear on the situation. You know, some animal doesn't have the same juice, right? Same power. Okay, anything else there? I think we got it there. Yeah, keep going.
There is no more tragic and pathetic experience on record illustrative of the heart-tearing contentions between ancient and time-honored religious customs and the contrary demands of advancing civilization than the Hebrew narrative of Jephthah and his only daughter. As was common custom, this well-meaning man had made a foolish vow, had bargained with the god of battles, agreeing to pay a certain price for victory over his enemies. And this price was to make a sacrifice of that which first came out of his house to meet him when he returned to his home. Jephthah thought that one of his trusty slaves would thus be on hand to greet him, but it turned out that his daughter and only child came out to welcome him home. And so, even at that late date, and among a supposedly civilized people, this beautiful maiden, after 2 months to mourn her fate, was actually offered as a human sacrifice by her father, and with the approval of his fellow tribesmen. And all of this was done in the face of Moses' stringent rulings against the offering of human sacrifice. But men and women are addicted to making foolish and needless vows, and the men of old held all such pledges to be highly sacred.
Yeah, I mean, and even though in, you know, current times, you don't have as much of that holding such pledges to be highly sacred, you still, it's what drives any sort of a drama show, is people making foolish and needless vows. I promise you, blah, 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 you know.
Have another drink.
You know, right? And I mean, like they say, we're just addicted to this. It gives us such a rush to think that we can just assert like that, and, you know, and it's so, and then you add in, you know, all of this very, very somber, serious, you know, perspective that humans had back then about such matters, and, you know, they're not, you know, even when it's your wonderful daughter, and the daughter, see, it's totally, it's like, oh, Dad, I mean, yes, I mean, you certainly should not, you know, go back on your vow. That would be much more horrible than me dying. You know, all I ask is just, you know, let me have a couple of months, you know, to mourn the fact that, you know, I'm not going to get married and have children now, which is what I feel was the whole reason for my existence, you know, but this is an important thing too, right? I thought that was why I existed, to have children, but actually I existed to be sacrificed, and I'm totally fine with that.
You could have had the servant tie her up so she couldn't come outside when he got home.
Yeah.
She wanted to check the CCTV and make sure she was the first one out.
Yeah.
Let's see, you know, she was, so Yeah, like they said, there's no more tragic and pathetic experience on record. And, you know, it's such a late date. You know, notice they med, you know, mentioned it. And all this was done in the face of Moses' stringent rulings again. You know, this is post-Moses and Joshua. Okay? And, you know, as they'll point out, you know, not only just a few centuries would they still bring in human sacrifice, but just throw in several more centuries forward, and they're still, they'll still do it, you know. And, you know, and fundamentally, again, that what that reminds you of is not that people didn't respect Moses. You know, it's not that they couldn't be very serious about such things and, like, respect what Moses said. But there's always something older than Moses, and hence more significant than Moses. And so that's that. Like we've pointed out over and over again, it is very difficult for us as animal origin creatures to not put a greater emphasis on the past than on the future, to genuinely be people of the future. Since it's even more difficult to be positive instead of negative, right, the natural state is going to tend to be past-oriented and negative, regretting the past, right, and dragging that into the present with whining over the present, right, which means, you know, you aren't oriented to the future, right? The future is effectively empty. You're vainly hoping for the future. That's the natural state. It's nothing to do with the fall of man or anything. That's what you can't help but do as you are maturing from a child of God. And if you think you don't regret the past and whine over the present, you're delusional. That's the way you start. You can't start any other way, and you have to unnaturally flip the arrow from backward to forward and maintain that flip, because it's going to want to flip back. The second Moses disappears, flip right back, right?
if it had been a slave who came out as expected, it wouldn't be in our record books.
Right.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a story in the book of Judges, right? Yeah.
And then accepted and come.
Yeah. You know, if there hadn't been human sacrifice, you wouldn't have that story of what incredible progress forward this was for Abraham to not sacrifice Isaac. I mean, you know, they're not just, you know, recording the facts of old. They're recording these significant either steps forward or reminders that you're unnaturally trying to take a step forward, right? Jephthah, is there to remind everyone of how naturally, this is, you'll go back like this. And it'll seem, everyone will agree it's appropriate, like they said there, with the approval of his fellow tribesmen. Right? He isn't just some guy with a big wall around his house trying to, live apart from the current mores, the advancing mores. So, to read the Bible, they're trying to help you with that, by saying these things, help you to read the Bible and see the truth that's there that someone a long time ago would have appreciated, but because, you're so apart from that culture, you don't think of it that way. All you can think of is, you just think about it factually and dismissively, right, because of its primitiveness or something. Right? But for the people of the day, right, they appreciated what the flow through the story was. They weren't just stuck in the words of the story, like humans are, who tend to be today.
Was this like post-Moses right here, or was this Moses
alive? No, like I said, it's post-Moses.
It's post-okay.
Yeah, it's after Moses and Joshua. It's during the period of the Judges.
To fall back.
Yeah. And let's see, anything else there? I think we got everything there. Other than just, you may notice that they said it twice. The beginning, foolish vow, and then they repeated it and doubled down, foolish and needless vows. Mm-hmm. So forget about the story from way back then, right? They're calling you a fool. Okay, catch yourself, right? You're wanting to do that, you know. Don't be so. You know, it's the seeds of self-righteousness when you think, you know, by your voice the universe, you know, has changed. You know, this, you know, I just say it and it's going to be. Yeah, we have to, you know, be more objective and humble, like you're saying about this, and. Catch yourself. You know, that's pride. There's an element of pride behind those vows. A lack of humility. Right?
In olden times, when a new building of any importance was started, it was customary to slay a human being as a foundation sacrifice. This provided a ghost spirit to watch over and protect the structure. When the Chinese made ready to cast a bell, custom decreed the sacrifice of at least one maiden from the purpose of improving the tone of the bell. The girl chosen was thrown alive into the molten metal.
Yeah. You know, and you go, well, why would they throw her alive into the molten metal? There's a physics to this, right? I mean, they're trying to put her active voice into the metal. If she's dead and not screaming, right, the physics is not there, right? So she has to be thrown alive in. You know, it's not just some notion that, you know, well, you know, the gods only like, you know, living sacrifices. They don't like dead ones. They're saying, you know, which might have been involved sometimes too, those sorts of notions. But here it's, you know, they're trying to get you to think about what they think the physics of this is. Her sweet, you know, tone is going to go into the metal. And again, the first story, you know, notice they threw in the quote-unquote physics sentence. This provided a ghost spirit to watch over and protect the structure. You know, so they're doing this, again, so that you aren't just... Oh, these horrible people and these human sacrifices. You know, they're so stupid and superstitious. It's like, you know, no, they're primitive and superstitious, but they aren't just that. They're also people that are trying to get science going. They're trying to think about how things work and trying to have a, you know, to understand the nature of things, the physics of things, and have a science, you know, a supposed science, a knowledge about how this all works. All right.
If they had known they could take a little metal from the last one and put it in the next one, and the ring would still work.
Yeah, well, you know, see, those sorts of thoughts would have eventually, you know, a substitution. You know, it's like, passing down the line with sourdough bread.
Yeah, right.
Right? You know, the substitution always refines these things, but you know, they can't be refined if they don't start coarse, right? So they all start very coarse and become more metaphoric and refined. Okay?
It was long the practice of many groups to build slaves alive into important walls. In later times, the Northern European tribes substituted the walling in of the shadow of a passer by for this custom of entombing living persons in the walls of new buildings. The Chinese buried in a wall those workmen who died while constructing it.
Yeah, like the wall, for instance, yeah, in China.
You're looking for walls with ears, these walls.
And obviously we're talking about substitution here again. And they literally say it. But don't forget... You know, you chuckle, oh, they're like, pretending, wink, wink, we're doing something real. You know, we'll wall the shadow in, No, again, remember, they thought of the shadow literally. That was literally the soul, right? I mean, they recognized, well, it's silly. I mean, why wall in all the stuff that's not the point of walling in? We only want the soul in there. See, so this isn't sort of just kind of a clever substitution because you're, you know, a little more tender-hearted, quote-unquote, about such things. Right? No, this was getting more scientific about it. Oh, like, wait a minute, I hadn't even thought about that. That's a total waste. I mean, why are we walling in the non-soul? That's, you know, who cares if the non-soul is in there? The whole point is just to wall in the soul.
Shadow knows.
You know, and prove to me that that shadow's not inside of there. well, let's check. You turn on the wall. See, the shadow's still there. Okay, but yeah, it's. I'm only belaboring this because I want you to remember that these people weren't, you know, as foolish as it seems. They had a scientific notion. I mean, there's, you know, it's just as objectively valid to wall in someone's shadow and hence wall in their soul, as it is, you know, to believe in curved space-time, mm-hmm. something like that, black holes, the Big Bang, right? There's no difference. Okay. So,
are they still using pictures for to do this?
You know, I mean, you know, at least their shadow concept is causal, right? Schrodinger's cat is not causal, right? And that's the whole point. It's like, whoa, we finally have liberated ourselves from the fetters of causality. We talk about the Lucifer rebellion.
Yeah.
okay. Anyway, I digressed. I'm sorry. But it's just, you know, you want to give these people the respect that they deserve, right? Because again, if you don't give them a little measure of evolutionary respect, how are you ever going to get to fatherly love relative to them? If you can't even respect them in an evolutionary sense, you'll never respect them in an existential sense. You got to get to that point. Because from a brotherly love point, you're not, you know. Your first thought is, oh, I should be kind to this person that's throwing the sweet little innocent Chinese girl into the molten metal. You know, is kindness the first thought that came to your mind when you hear that? No, but not only, you know, can't you get hung up there? You got to go two levels up to that to get to fatherly love. Right? The father loves that person that's throwing her into the molten metal, and he loves the girl that's being thrown in the molten metal. It's like, well, if he loved the girl being thrown in the metal, why didn't he save her? Again, right, that's a temporal thought. Fatherly love is not about time. Brotherly love is about time. Fatherly love has no relationship to time. Right? Has no relationship to experience. Of course, the father saved her before she was born. Right? The father had a personality for that little girl before the universe existed.
So it's perspective.
Right, it's perspective, right? And it's just, can you back away from time and all of its compelling, you know, suffering and whatnot, see things in a more eternalized way? You have to, because you're trying to, are you not trying to get to fatherly love? Did Jesus not say you should try to love, you know, as I love, as the Father loves? You've got to back up from all of your feelings that are generated by temporal affairs if you're going to do that. You don't want to, you know, you don't dismiss such things. But those are things of Caesar, those temporal issues. The things of God are eternal issues. Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Just a little off topic, probably. So the girl that got sacrificed in those day and age,
may or may not have had a thought adjuster, correct? So,
yeah.
Okay, so if they didn't, is that person, is that personality resurrectable?
No, if that girl didn't have, because it's obvious she's less than 16, you know, or something, you know, so she's not even disconnected from her parents mindily yet, or, you know, she's obviously a young girl probably. You know, if she didn't have an adjuster, then, you know, then you've got to even, you have to step back even further to be objective about it and recognize, oh, it appeared that there was a little individual that's part of eternity that was born and living there, but really, that's part of the supreme being, because that's where that personality goes. If there's no adjuster, and hence no soul, there's a lot of qualifications here. I mean, and if she can't get resurrected in the probationary nursery, right? You know, to push it all the way to what you were thinking of, right? You know, there's a lot of asterisks that come in to salvage the children of time. Even getting an adjuster for reasons that no one can understand, you know. Okay, but if we say all of the, you know, she's fallen through all the cracks, if you will, she's not iniquitous, but she just did not have an adjuster, and her parents weren't resurrected, you know, so that she could be resurrected in probationary nursery and all this. Okay, then that personality becomes part of the supreme being when all is said and done. Right? And really that potential purposing of that personality is part of the purposing that's inherent in the supreme being, not in me or you or some other individual. It's that individual's personality. And it's very difficult to sort that through, because in order to think about it well, you have to let go of time being a reality. This is the problem here. When you think about it from a time viewpoint, and hence you're kind of giving time some reality, you know, you've got this kind of strange thing that her personality becomes part of a summation of personalities in God the Almighty, and eventually God the Almighty integrates with God the Mother to make God the Supreme. Okay? You have this, it's like, well, that just feels weird. I thought personality was your inherent, you know, oneness potential, your indivisibility potential. You're talking about personality that's a summation, and hence there's all this divisibility. See, that's because it doesn't seem to make sense, because you're looking at it from the time viewpoint, and you know, you're effectively giving time a reality when you do that. What you really have to do is look at it from the eternity viewpoint, from the top down. Okay, really, from the top down, you just have the supreme being, and there's no tearing apart of his personality or anything. Really, you know, as you think about downstepping that absonite being down into the finite, right? He's an integrous, indivisible personality. Right? But the, you know, when we talk about that finite below and we understand it with God the Almighty, the summation, and God the Mother, the focalization, and all that, yeah, that's just so we can make sense out of that. See, remember, really what you have is the cosmos infinite, complete. Always was, always will be. What you really have is the cosmos infinite complete. And you are slowly synchronizing with that fact. And the appearance that you have as you slowly synchronize with that fact is that there's this thing called time, you know, that everything is marching along towards an eventual synthesis called the cosmos infinite. See, but that's not really what's going on. Time's not a reality, right? You're projecting out, right? Really what's going on is your whole relationship to everything is evolving, not it's evolving. And it's difficult to sort that through because you're going, well, wait a minute. Well, what about Bob over there or Betty over there? I mean, you know, doesn't time have to be apart from all of them? Because we can't be all projecting and it all magically overlays. Yeah, well, is Bob's mind and Betty's mind some absolute separate nugget from your mind? No. It's all one contiguous mind, right? We're all immersed in it. We're all coordinated in it. We're all, so our projections are coordinated, right? Our appearances are coordinated. But really, okay, this is the fifth epical revelation. He's actually trying to get us to that. See, really what you have is something very different than what it appears. Right? Really, there is no disassembled supreme being down in the finite. It just appears that way when you look at the supreme being with your limitedly focused eyes. It's a fact that you can't bring your eyes to a focus that it appears that he's disassembled. But when you can finally focus your eyes, you'll find that he's assembled. And action in your right, oh, actually, he was always assembled. I didn't assemble him by focusing my eyes better. And that's what you'll eventually discover. He really is there, always was, always will be, a member of the cosmos infinite. You're just trying to get to the point where you can see that.
So there's a difference then in the personality that becomes of that world, becomes a part of the supreme, and the personality that continues to live on with people that, you know, let's say get to the core finality.
To make a long story short, I went off on that tangent. But see, go back to the little girl and her personality. You're looking at this girl. It appears you're looking at a personality there. No, you're looking at an aspect of the Supreme Being's personality that you haven't yet focused in.
I gotcha.
That's literally what's there. I mean, it isn't literally that, you know, she doesn't survive and therefore an individual disappears out of the cosmos infinite. That's not what's happening, right? It's not like all those magical time travel things and stuff, you know, where, you know, your parents die and so you're never born and, you know, you were never born and so you disappear, all that sort of magical sort of stuff. Okay, that's not what's going on. See, she's really not there. She's really part of the Supreme Being. That's what you discover when all is said and done. And see, that's just a very much more complicated phenomenon that you thought was possible. And the reason you thought that such a phenomenon was impossible is because you've never learned about the mother. All you've learned about is a father, the individuality of the parts. And so you believe in the absoluteness of parts and nothing in between them except magic. See, that's not really what's going on. Like, my mind is an absolute part, you know, and nothing between my mind and your mind. It's like, actually, there are no mindal parts. Mind is a contiguous energy system that's never broken off in chunks. Okay? It's very different than what it appears, right?
And personality is not the same as that, though, right?
Personality is, right, absolutely unique. But see, I mean, if I, conceptually, I could take my personality and conceptually break it up into parts, each part would be absolutely unique, too. right? If the whole is absolutely unique, I see that, and that's what effectively, you know, her, the little girl's personality is absolutely unique, you know, okay, but really it's just a part of a bigger personality, if you will, right? You're not actually looking, you can't look, see, again, another way of saying what I'm saying is, you should be reminded of how difficult it is for you to think or see holistically. I mean, you're so part-wise instead of holistic in your sight that you literally see the Supreme Being disassembled, as if someone had chopped him up and spread him all over the place. Okay? But, you know, when I say that, it's like, well, that sounds absurd. Yeah, see, that's obviously absurd. It's like, well, how did I end up with that absurd conclusion? Because I assumed time was a reality. That's how I got to that absurd conclusion. If I stop assuming time is a reality, I can't get to that absurd conclusion. See, that's reductio ad absurdum. It proves that my initial assumption that time is a reality is false. Time can't be a reality, or it leads to absurdities like that, like someone chopped up the Supreme Being. Okay?
But isn't the sequence a reality?
Sequence is, right? But that, see, that sequentiality is in your mind. That consciousness of sequentiality is in your mind. Right? And you project that out as a quote-unquote reified time. Right? And again, I'll tell you that directly in the book. I'm not making that up. They tell you literally where the sequentiality is. It's not out there. It's in your mind.
So the difference then of here today and being a finaliter in 200 billion years is not time, but experience.
But experience, yes. Right? Right? And the literalness that as the more experientialized you become, the more focused your sight becomes. The more you can see things for the whole that they are, instead of all disassembled and part-like. Right? It really is all one fully integrated system. No matter how much it seems like it's all broken apart into divorced chunks. You know, and this table, you know, has nothing to do, you know, with a rice paddy in the Far East. Okay, it just appears that it doesn't. Really, everything is all one integrated system. You know, you're completely in eternity. You're completely integrated, synchronized with every single automaton and every single personality in the cosmos infinite. Right? But, you know, you can't see that right now. It doesn't appear that way to you right now. Not all you have to do is, you don't have to deny the appearance. Just stop assuming that the appearance is reality. Right? Stop projecting. Right? Stop being so self-righteous. Right? You don't define your appearance. You know, what the appearances that you have don't define reality. They're just appearances. Okay. Wow, that was a tangent. But okay. Meanwhile, back to things like Jephthah and his daughter and then our foundation sacrifices and our bells and and remember the last thing we had was the shadow. And, you know, they're pointing out that, you know, like when they're making the Great Wall of China, you know, and they're tossing all the bodies into it, you know, they haven't gotten a little bit more refined. If they had a little bit more of a refined thought, they weren't trying to just like be dismissive and abusive of the bodies, throwing them in, you know, like some mafia guy dumping somebody wants to get rid of into the concrete of some building, right? You know, it wasn't like that. You know, eventually, they would have gotten a little bit more refined, and it's like, well, actually, I don't want to put the whole body in there. That's pointless. You know, we should just bury the soul, whatever they think the soul is. You know, maybe they don't think it's the shadow, but whatever they think the soul is, you know, bury the breath into it, you know, or whatever. You know, they could just rationalize, well, he was right there working on the building when he took his last breath, and so his breath went into the stones of the wall, and, you know, he's there. However they would rationalize it.
A petty king in Palestine, in building the walls of Jericho, laid the foundation thereof in Abraham, his firstborn, and set up the gates thereof in his youngest son, Segub. At that late date, not only did this father put two of his sons alive in the foundation holes of the city's gates, but his action is also recorded as being according to the word of the Lord. Moses had forbidden these foundation sacrifices, but the Israelites reverted to them soon after his death. The 20th century ceremony of depositing trinkets and keepsakes in the cornerstone of a new building is reminiscent of the primitive foundation sacrifices.
Yeah, and just, you know, reminding you that initially you were putting stuff in the cornerstone, not because you wanted to put the matter in there, but the soul of the object in there, right? You know, the thing that we, the word we use when we're talking about the soul of something instead of just the something directly, we use the word nostalgic, right? You know, and the nostalgia of taking this, you know, long 100 years later or whatever, taking this stuff out of the cornerstone and, you know, and nostalgically reminiscing about it, right? You know, in the past, you thought more literally, you know, that you were synchronizing, you were feeling the souls in those objects, see, when you did that. And so so they're just reminding you that you're bearing... these two sons were buried in there because you didn't have some scheme about how to get the separated soul buried in there, right? So you had, you know, while the soul is still connected to the body and because they're alive, you buried in there. So you've got Abiram and Segub. being kludged into this, again, over many centuries, you've got this rationalization scheme going that they're alluding to there, quote-unquote, according to the word of the Lord. Right. So we're way, way, you know, down the road from you know, like Jephthah we're talking about there and all that sort of stuff. We're way, way, way down the road from Moses, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years down the road. But this is tidying up a loose end way back with Joshua, you know, right immediately after Moses, when Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down, right? The idea was that God didn't want those walls to be rebuilt, and so, you know, through Joshua, God put a curse on this, you know, against anyone who would rebuild the walls. Yeah, so go forward many centuries, and a guy rebuilds the walls. And, okay, they're pointing out, he's doing it because of human sacrifice. But the Bible uses that as the rationalization scheme. See, God did curse it. He had to pay the curse. His sons died, you know. And, of course, they went back and put the words of Joshua's curse back there to match up with the story, right? To make this nice little tidy thing as they're putting that all together during the exile, when they're putting the Old Testament together during the exile. That's what they're referring to there. So much for curses and prophecies and all, you know, it's all just a posteriori kludging, right? After the fact kludging of this stuff to make it all look like the hand of God is in control of everything. Let's keep on.
It was long the custom of many peoples to dedicate the first fruits to the spirits, and these observances, now more or less symbolic, are all survivals of the early ceremonies involving human sacrifice. The idea of offering the firstborn as a sacrifice was widespread among the ancients, especially among the Phoenicians, who were the last to give it up. It used to be said upon sacrificing, life for life, now you say it death, dust to dust.
What's now Lebanon area, immediately north of Palestine, the Phoenicians, they're reminding you of how immediate a cultural influence there was on the Jews, long, long, long forward, to remind them of the supposed power of human sacrifice. It wasn't just people off in some unknown land, in some depths of some jungle or something, right? I mean, right there, they were getting reinforced with the human sacrifice concept until very, very late.
Phoenicians who taught the Romans crucifixion.
Well, yeah, I mean, and of course, at the same time, the Phoenicians have all kinds of positive influences too. I mean, it's a mixed bag. Like they were pointing out, you can take all the greatest civilizations, that all did fantastic, important things in certain areas, but they all had human sacrifice. Yeah, didn't matter if Chinese, Egyptians, Romans, you name it, everyone. It was very, very widespread. And then to get you to reflect on the, at the end there, they used to say life for life. Now we say dust to dust. Pause and reflect on that and kind of get that. The point is that the way this stuff was rationalized is in that zero-sum game mode that humans are very want to do. It's very difficult for humans to think in genuating, originating terms. So whether or not they're thinking economically or about human sacrifice, whatever, they think in a zero-sum game sense. That if, the only way for someone to get more money is to take it from someone else, right? The only way for a life, for someone to be born, and hence there to be life, is that other life had to go away, right? There's just a fixed amount of life. Right, and so you sacrifice someone so that their life can get reused. It's a recycle program, right? It's exactly the same spirit, pardon the pun, that drives recycling. Okay, and you can say no, that's all a very material pragmatism thing. Yeah, but where does the religious energy behind these pragmatic things that we're doing come from, right? It comes from that sense that it's, there's just a fixed pool of whatever, life or stuff or whatever, and you have to just keep it going around and around, in the reincarnation-like circle.
I always thought dust to dust meant that we were made out of dust and we ended up going back into dust.
Right, but yeah, of course. But see, to think about that a little less scientifically, so you got to, don't be quite so post, Enlightenment scientific about it, right? The point, it's the same thing. Now, there's only so much dust, and humans come up out of the dust. If a human is going to be able to come up out of the dust again, some human has to go back into the dust. See, so they're trying to point out, we think of it less literally now, but they're trying to remind you it has a literal root in the life for life, in this zero-sum game sense. How many stories have you, heard where someone says, we need to restore the balance in the universe, right? Right? That's a zero-sum mentality, right? That, if there's a lot of evil here, it prevents there being goodness. There's some 50-50 balance, say, between bad and good, and if you get more good, in some area it's at the expense of, more bad in some area it's at the expense of good in some other area. And all that sort of thinking.
It's directly what's behind. If you have a nation that's more advanced and wealthier, more powerful than other nations,
right.
Well, it's just assumed that they got that way by taking away from those nations.
Of course. Right. It's always assumed that if there's a wealthy nation, it was at the expense of others. It couldn't be anything else, everyone naturally thinks.
That's like the farmer where they talked about whose crops did well, had to have stolen.
Right. had to have right. It's the exact same thing. You know, but when you hear the crop one, you know, everyone chuckles. But when you hear the one about the wealthy nation and the poor nations, everyone nods their head in bovine agreement. Oh, of course that's why. It's like, no, it's the same stupid story as the farmer that had more crop and he had to have stolen it from other people's fields. It's the same mentality. Right? We can't fool ourselves because we get more sophisticated about it. Okay? It's a simple-minded, zero-sum mentality. See, in other words, the fact that you generally think about that like that, no one really has recognized what the word creativity means. Right? They're just thinking inventiveness, cleverness. Okay? Its mere form is a rearranging. Right? But genuine creativity originates. Right? You bring into something into existence that wasn't there. You didn't take something that was there and rearranged it. You brought something new into existence, right? And it's like, well, yeah, but I my artwork or whatever, I took matter. It was always there. I didn't bring the matter out. Yeah, so see, the matter and the rearranging is not the creativity, is it? Right? Creativity is a higher concept than something that's a property of matter, right? So trying to get you to reflect on what genuine originality is, what a genuine personality brings into play. A personality originates, right? And what you potentially can originate, the Universal Father can't, right? The purposing that can originate what you can, he divested himself of. You are in possession of that and no one else. Your personality has certain originating potentials that is not existent anywhere else in infinity. That's the whole point, right? You know, and if you can think of, again, if you can think of someone else doing what you're doing that you're calling creative, it isn't really creative, right? Your creativity is something only you, you got to think about, I know that not even the Universal Father could have done this and not be self-righteous, you know, delusional about it when you say that. That's the fact of it. And it's like, well, what on earth? I mean, I believe in a magical God. I mean, the Universal Father can make square circles. He can do anything. No, he can't do what you can do, really. Yeah. What is your real personality?
Huh? His creativity to divest it to you.
Yeah. He creatively divested, a lot of that potential purposing to everyone else. He only kept what he had to. A very core existential, initiating sort of, purposing. But, again, not to belabor that, but, to go back to this, constant drumbeat of zero-sum thinking. Right? Sure, it is the case that your body, is quote-unquote dust and it goes back to dust. But is that all you are as a body? And are you making sure that you remind yourself of that? Or do you kind of just ball all yourself into that and so you're kind of just really in the life, the life, recycling mentality. There's a part of you that can't go back. That can only go forward. because it really isn't going forward in time. It's part of eternity. And that's the part that you want to, you know, what is your absolutely unique part of the cosmos infinite? See, no one else has a hold of that part. You're the only one. Universal Father doesn't have a hold of that part. That's your part. And can you begin to do things in time predicated on that absolute originality that's in eternity right now?
It was given to you.
It was given to you by grace, right? Came from eternity, is of eternity. Right? All right. So, what else we have here?
The spectacle of Abraham constrained to sacrifice his son Isaac, while shocking to civilized susceptibilities, was not a new or strange idea to the men of those days. It was long a prevalent practice for fathers at times of great emotional stress to sacrifice their firstborn sons. Many peoples have a tradition analogous to this story, for there once existed a worldwide and profound belief that it was necessary to offer a human sacrifice when anything extraordinary or unusual happened.
Okay, notice these two paragraphs are together, set apart by a large paragraph break. So if we figured out something that was going on in the preceding paragraph, we can apply it here probably quite immediately. That last statement, right? It was necessary to offer a human sacrifice when anything extraordinary or unusual happened. Because again, something incredible came forth, right? That has to be at the expense of something else, right? Human sacrifice is just accepting that physics. Something has to disappear for something to appear. Something can't just appear. It's an insidious thing. Because at the same time, you're going, well, isn't that correct? I mean, you can't get something from nothing. That's why the Big Bang is absurd. Yeah, but what are they missing? They're blurring two things together. That originating, that creativity, you aren't literally bringing something into existence out of nothing, right? You're converting a potentiality to an actuality. Right. You're not taking it.
Pulling apart.
Okay. But see, so yeah, it's not coming out of nothing. But there's a way of having it not come out of nothing when as it comes into existence. Besides, for there to be a certain actuality, you got to get rid of another actuality. Right? There's another option except just swapping actualities, which is what they're thinking. Right? There's potentiality that can be converted, transformed into actuality. And that to think about that is obviously a more abstract concept. It's more difficult for humans to get to that. It's not the way where you're going to start. Humans just were barely kind of getting that, and then we started losing it again to really... To have a logical understanding of things that wasn't the old recycling model.
Yep. Well, this tension that builds up, it's what's behind war fever. It's like things get worked up to such a state. The only solution is to shed blood,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I mean, remember they mentioned that's that same sort of you've got to keep the recycling process going. I mean, war was rationalized into that, it's like I was saying, it's you could go on and on all night long. It's a very universal concept that's insidiously into almost everything that we, how we rationalize almost everything. And to pull back from that and try to think of a genuinely real new way of understanding stuff, except in this life for life, you know, sort of yin and yang mentality, right? The only way to have white is to have black or whatever, right? I mean, and you got to restore the balance, right? There's too much black or there's too much white or, you know, and all that sort of thinking, you have to be very careful to keep it appropriately in its place and not, I guess maybe the way to think about it, don't existentialize it. You know? Don't overplay it, right? Don't make it sort of the foundational answer to everything, right? Sure, there's issues of balance, okay? But it isn't the fundamental driving fact of the universe. Will is, okay? No, not balance. let's see. I guess we got everything there, didn't we? The thing that makes you kind of think about it is we so often don't say civilized susceptibilities, but sensibilities now is much more common. You know, it's really saying the same thing. The whole point of those expressions is, are you being taken over by emotions, and hence you're under, you know, the prefix there is sub, it's below. Are you under your emotions? Are you under control of your emotions? In other words, not that emotions are bad, but okay, they need a bridle on them, right? I mean, at some point you got to check them, right? You can't let them be the final word. And while shocking to civilized susceptibilities, you know, you're susceptible to having emotion be the final say. It's like, well, that's bad because I have an icky emotional response to that. Okay? To have a pleasant emotional response to that. See, that's what they're getting at there. See, there's a little jab between the lines, right, that sure, you're more refined, and that's okay, that's fine in its place, but notice you have a tendency to overplay that, right, and be too emotional about things. And, to the point where, you know, you start to try to create a civilization where no one can ever die. Or something. You're taking it too far. Everybody's going to die. You got to die of something. You got to remind yourself of that fact. You know, emotionally, we don't want anyone or anything to die.
It's either die or fuse.
Right? So, and to fuse is to die, right? Right? The part that you don't want to die still dies in fusion, right? I mean, your mortal self still dies in fusion. Right. It can't do anything but die. It's mortal. Right? Fusion isn't magically making a mortal self immortal. It's the immortal self that fuses to the adjuster. The mortal self dies. It's completely obliterated.
Dust to dust.
It's a glorious way to die. Right? It's the most glorious way for your mortal self to die, is to be vaporized by your immortal self fusing. Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole point. There's three cells. The immortal, potentially immortal self becomes more immortal when it fuses with the adjuster self. The third self, the mortal self, always dies one way or another, right?
Well, it was sacrificed.
it's sacrificed. All right, on that note, I can't say any more. That's an appropriate way to go to the next section.
7, modifications of human sacrifice. Moses attempted to end human sacrifices by inaugurating the ransom as a substitute. He established a systematic schedule which enabled his people to escape the worst results of their rash and foolish vows. Liens, properties, and children could be redeemed according to the established fees, which were payable to the priests. Those groups which ceased to sacrifice their firstborn soon possessed great advantages over less advanced neighbors who continued these atrocious acts. Many such backward tribes were not only greatly weakened by this loss of sons, but even the succession of leadership was often broken.
Yeah, so, you know, someone like Moses is trying to, you know, bring some of that objectivity of that parallel stream that Melchizedek established to help with the progress of civilization. You know, they recognize the things that are holding civilization back or even militating against civilization. And, you know, so it's not just, I have a different arbitrary set of religious notions. Okay. There actually is a sense of trying to foster the progress of civilization. And so, you know, here's this substitution thing again that we've been chuckling about some. But see, it's very important. You can't just do stuff cold turkey, as we say these days, right? Change. We have to evolve it effectively in a gradual way. So substitution is indispensable to that process of transitioning away from all the literalnesses of sacrifice. And so you've got the land or property or a child that, you know, is now that you've put into a vow and instead of having to sacrifice those things literally, it all seems, oh, look at this clever deal that the priests dreamt up here to enrich themselves. You know, guess what? How you can ransom? You give us money. And okay, but you know, don't so fixate on the money part of it, because they aren't just going to make a dragon pile of gold that they're going to sit on. Okay, they're going to use that money for quote unquote good works. Right, and so it has an initial quote unquote spiritual notion that the person needs to be sacrificed, and in the end you have a final quote unquote spiritual notion that you're doing good works. Okay, the fact that there's a material process through which you transition from one spiritual notion to the other, don't judge it by the material part, the money stuff in between. Okay.
And money is more than just a material thing.
Yeah.
If we didn't have a relationship to spirit, we couldn't value money.
Yeah. Quote unquote, value money. Right. All these spirit words that we use for material things. Yeah, and again, I'm just, you know, I'm trying to point out that another reason, you know, it's not just like greed and stuff like that. And like I said, it's not just to get a pile of gold that you sit on like a greedy dragon. The very fact that money can be this conduit from spiritual to spiritual tells you, quote unquote, logically, right, that spirit must flow through it. So it just, it adds to our fascination with money. It spiritualizes greed in the end, right? Makes people all the more greedy. The very fact that you've discovered that you can use material money as a means to spiritual ends is telling you, oh, well, there must be spirit that you know is in the money, and so you start to fall in love not with the shininess of the gold, but of the soul of the gold, the spirit inside of the gold, you start to fall in love with, you know, and it's my precious.
Mm. Didn't you?
See? Yeah, see, that's what, you know. What?
The love of wealth, didn't you warn against that?
Yeah, see, the love of wealth. See, again, think about that. I mean, the love is a spirit word, and, you know, he wasn't just using it flippantly. That's like I'm saying. See, you spiritize the money. That's what really gets you going with it, right? It's not your practical sense that's driving you. You got to get a false spiritualization of something to really get zealous about it and apply your sixth adjutant to it, and we'd be willing to go to any lengths, right, to achieve it or more money or whatever. And you got to religiousize it, quote unquote. See, and that's how it's happening. And again, it all happens. It might happen totally unconsciously. But these subtle things, your logical mind wants to be consistent. It doesn't want to magically go from spirit to matter and back to spirit. It wants to have spirit continuously all the way through. And so you end up spiritizing the money in between, which ends up making it more difficult to be objective about money and not get all caught up in it. Okay?
Tithe is special money.
All right. And tithing is special money and all that sort of stuff, right? Yeah. Because it's a sacrifice. Yes, yeah, I remember we were talking about sacrifice. See, it's a sacrifice to God. And again, we've already developed, when you're sacrificing to God, you're not sacrificing matter. The whole point of sacrifice is that it has a soul. It's a spirit, thing that's, the cannibalism and stuff kind of got you to really differentiate the matter from what you think is the important part, the spiritual part, that's with it or inside of it or whatever. So, yeah, keep this all integrated as you, try to come to a better understanding of what's going on. All right, so let's see. Here we are with foolish vows again. Did I tell you that they're foolish? It's a whole system, right? It's a complete lifestyle solution. Here you establish a systematic schedule. Okay, everything has a fee attached to it, and the Pharisees, were great for, getting this down to the 10th decimal place of minutia. And let's see here. What else do we have there? Oh, yeah, and then the rest was just that pragmatic stuff. But it obviously in between there, we've got this other issue of priests. It's problematic enough when you've got people who are thinking that they're specially connected to God, unlike other people. And then you bring money into it, and it's going to ever more complicate the problem. Yeah. So eventually you've got a civilization practically destroying phenomenon of the priesthood.
An outgrowth of the passing child sacrifice was the custom of smearing blood on the house doorpost for the protection of the firstborn. This was often done in connection with one of the sacred feasts of the year, and this ceremony once obtained over most of the world from Mexico to Egypt.
Yeah, we just recently went through Passover, did we not? And they're just trying to, get you to think a little bit more properly in evolutionary terms about that. It's not just some arbitrary, magical notion, right? It's helping you to have a visual reminder that you don't want to fall back into the natural human sacrifice thing. You're trying to be civilized. You're going to move forward to animal substitution. You sacrifice the animal. You put its blood on the doorposts, so that the demands of God, that might want to enter the door, see the demands have been met by the animal blood. God doesn't go inside and see the child and, that child is mine. You should give me your child, right? He's satisfied before he enters, And you might be what you're kind of thinking consciously is what I just said, right? That it's all about God and kind of keeping God satisfied. But actually, you're trying to remind yourself, okay, you don't have to sacrifice your son. I don't know. I feel like this is really, really significant. I think I've got to sacrifice. No, you don't have to. Right? We now know that the animal completely satisfies, you know, Yahweh. Right? And you're reminding yourself of that. But sometimes when the story is told, it all seems kind of magical. You know, this magic blood, you know, and the evil force tries to enter and it can't get in because there's a spiritual force field or something, you know. And I mean, that's why we often depict it or visualize it. But actually, it's just reminders that, you know, it's why you told the Abraham-Isaac story, to remind you, we've made that step forward. Remember, here's the story. Well, now, what, don't I just say, no, okay, that story, that reminds me. It's there to remind you to not turn back to the more natural old ways. Okay, and again, it was, like you're saying, it was everywhere. You know, every time I read this, I'm always very grateful that I live when I do, being a firstborn son. It's like, yeehaw! Because, you know, it would have been, yeah, problematic back in the day. All right.
Even after most groups had ceased the ritual killing of children, it was the custom to put an infant away by itself, off in the wilderness, or in a little boat on the water. If the child survived, it was thought that the gods had intervened to preserve him, as in the traditions of Sargon, Moses, Cyrus, and Romulus. Then came the practice of dedicating the firstborn sons as sacred or sacrificial, allowing them to grow up and then exiling them in lieu of death. This was the origin of colonization. The Romans adhered to this custom in their scheme of colonization.
So if I'd been born way back, I would have been sacrificed. Not so way back, I would have, you know, been sent off to parts unknown to colonize it. So see, you're sacrificing your homeland instead of your life. And we all know how important our homeland is to us. Again, genetically, we can't, you know, just biologically, we can't help but be identified with where we were born. So it feels spiritual, it feels consequential, it feels like a genuine sacrifice to be exiled from where you were born. But people weren't so stuck. So again, these superstitions, you know, start to get transportation improvements and all kinds of things, you know, get going. And of course, we saw in there, everyone knows the Moses story, but you know, I think most people know that that's a common story, all really cool people. You know, the reason they're cool is because God touched them, you know. Any baby put out like that is going to die. If they don't die, the only explanation is God intervened, right, and touched them for greatness. Right, so that's how they rationalize. You know, and again, we still think in basically that mode. That person should have died. Okay, but they didn't. Well, the only possible explanation is the power of prayer. The touch of God. Right? All you've done is you've added that you had to coerce God into it. Instead of here, with, at least with the basket thing, God just did it. it's a little less delusional, but...
The power of prayer does work. But the question is, you know, it's not necessarily God intervening in direct way, but perhaps in an indirect way through the individual's own mind or whatever in the power of prayer. There is some truth in the fact that something goes on.
Well, again, see, this is where we have to really step back. I don't want to go way off because, as Hugh said, we're going to spend a whole chapter on prayer, but just remember, the story that we make a movie about is the child is near death, should have died. Everyone in the town prays, and the child lives. We don't make the movie about child is near death, he should die, everyone prays, child dies anyway. No one makes a movie about that story.
But I wasn't talking about that so much, the child, but I was talking more about even the book talks about.
Right. We'll right. But that's all I'm talking about right now. We'll get into where prayer, is genuinely effective when we talk about prayer. But again, we have to be able to examine prayer and recognize where there's a reality to it and where there isn't. Because again, it's the confirmation thing we think is proof. If the child lives, that confirms that prayer, was the cause of his living. Just like they were saying right here. That if Moses lives, that proves that God saved Moses. Right? It doesn't occur to them. It's like, no, just coincidentally, Moses might have lived. Right? All right? And, what about the really fantastic genetic person that was floated as a little baby out in the boat and died? Much better genetics than Moses. What about that one? Why is there a story about that kid?
Yeah, because he's part of the Supreme now.
That kid was probably resurrected in a probationary nursery. If their genetics was really great, their parents probably had an adjuster. right? I mean, again, we have to recognize that. We know that it's uncommon that everyone prays and the child lives. That's why we do a movie about it, because it's so uncommon. We know kind of unconsciously that the common thing is the child doesn't live. But then we turn right around and forget that, and present the story as proof, right? Yeah. And the more you think it's proof, the more the mother or the parents of the child that died anyway is stuck with this, what did I do? I mean, I must have sinned. God doesn't love me. I mean, like mom over there, God saved that mom's child. Why didn't God save my child? We all know this is the silliness that humans get into. It's like, no, God didn't save that child any more than he killed yours or didn't save yours. Right? You're starting with a false initial assumption. Okay. Keep going here.
Many of the peculiar associations of sex laxity with primitive worship had their origin in connection with human sacrifice. In olden times, if a woman met headhunters, she could redeem her life by sexual surrender. Later, a maiden consecrated to the gods as a sacrifice might elect to redeem her life by dedicating her body for life to the sacred sex service of the temple. In this way, she could earn her redemption money. The ancients regarded it as highly elevating to have sex relations with a woman thus engaged in ransoming her life. It was a religious ceremony to consort with these sacred maidens, and in addition, this whole ritual afforded an acceptable excuse for commonplace sexual gratification. This was a subtle species of self-deception, which both the maidens and their consorts delighted to practice upon themselves. The mores always drag behind in the evolutionary advance of civilization, thus providing sanction for the earlier and more savage-like sex practices of the evolving races.
Okay, so in the end, you get the whole, you're going to repeat that, all the power of the older stuff. But see how useful this redemption concept can be here. It isn't just, you don't just have substitution so that it's not so savage, okay? But it leads immediately to this redemption concept, which is, has all kinds of, the gears just start turning. It's like, oh man, what we can do with redemption. Right? Again, we're all, you culminate this in the Christian tradition with the whole rationalization of Jesus's death, right? Notice how they're trying to emphasize, don't think about this so merely biologically, physically, okay? And our sex urge and all this sort of stuff. Sure, that's there, can't help, but the important thing is what they don't think that's the most important thing there, like some of us in a, in puerile fashion might think that that's the most important thing there. Right, it's the spirit stuff, right? I mean, This woman is fully plugged into the whole flow of God energy here. I mean, if you have sex with her, I mean, you're going to get a booster shot of spiritual nature. Right? So, you know, they believed in that very literally.
Worked for me.
And like I said, see, this sort of thinking where you literally, again, have quote-unquote spirit going through a material conduit adds to the material fact, be it money or sex, right? Getting this, religiousizing this, oh, this is really, really exciting and compelling. See, it makes that all the more difficult to be managed well by society because you've, quote-unquote, spiritualized it, you've energized it, made it really, really compelling, okay, and powerful. By getting it involved in something that you think is spiritual, like redemption. Yeah. All right. Let's see here. Anything else they had there? Remember, don't forget we're talking about sacrifice too, right? So, you're substituting a sex sacrifice, you know, for her literal sacrifice with the headhunter, say. And that just, you know, if that's going to be a proper substitution, you're going to have to think about sex in a fancier way than the animals do. Remember, humans were very matter-of-fact to begin with about sex. No one had any fancy notions about it. They were very... It's totally matter of fact, you know, because they watched the animals and they thought of themselves as fancy animals and didn't think of really anything of sex. But here, I mean, if sex is going to be a substitute for literal sacrifice, okay, I mean, sex can't be just matter of fact animal stuff. This has got to be very, very profound. Like I said, it's you're augmenting all these things by quote unquote spiritualizing them like this. Okay.
Temple harlotry eventually spread throughout Southern Europe and Asia. The money earned by the temple prostitutes was held sacred among all peoples, a high gift to present to the gods. The highest type of women thronged the temple sex marts and devoted their earnings to all kinds of sacred services and works of public good. Many of the better classes of women collected their dowries by temporary sex service in the temples, and most men preferred to have such women for wives.
Just giving you more details about, like I was saying, it's just how significant this is, and hence all the different ways that it can, you know, this concept can be rationalized. And notice they said, just what I was saying, you know, about how it all ends up, you know, don't focus on just the money or the sex, right? I mean, it all ends up with public good. Good is a spirit word. Right, so that's that, like I said, that's what's powering all this, and don't think that this energization of money and sex is way in the rearview mirror. Right? It isn't. It's, you know, we've powered it up like this, and it's going to be a long time to de-energize it, you know, in our minds. Especially if you have any Andite blood, right? It makes it all the more difficult to think about money or sex in just a matter-of-fact way. You resonate with this sort of rationalization all the more.
Yeah. Most men preferred to have such women because these women were socially progressive.
Mm-hmm.
High-minded.
Yes, I mean, they were, you know, you were marrying this wonderful woman who's, you know, was willing to sacrifice, you know, profoundly for the public good. I mean, what a wonderful woman this is, you know. Not some selfish woman, you know, who just enjoys sex. See, it's just, Like they mentioned, see, there is a subtle species of self-deception, you know, going on in all this too, right? Yeah. Anyway, all right, yeah, let's read a little bit more about this redemption. See, like, you know, see, they, I told you they were building up. That's the key concept that gets distilled out of all this, all these shenanigans. Ooh, redemption. Okay.
8, redemption in covenants. Sacrificial redemption and temple prostitution were in reality modifications of human sacrifice. Next came the mock sacrifice of daughters. This ceremony consisted in bloodletting with dedication to lifelong virginity and was a moral reaction to the older temple harlotry. In more recent times, virgins dedicated themselves to the service of tending to the sacred temple fires.
So again, just that normal evolution is like, oh, that is just wrong. Temple harlotry is just wrong, you say. You know, they should be, you know, tending the sacred temple fires as the, you know, as the temple virgins. They should sacrifice, having children. And
is that the nuns do now?
Right, of course. That's the whole, that's why what the nun is doing is significant, right? Because she's made a sacrifice. And it's just as significant as if she had offered up her body as a human sacrifice. Don't forget that, you know, don't judge it by what it is now. Judge it by what it, you know, is a substitution for. Okay? Judge it, you know, along the evolutionary line. You know, she's not going to marry a man. She's going to marry the church, or she's going to marry Jesus, you know, in some sense, or whatever. Right? And her children are going to be, you know, stored up as treasures in heaven rather than on earth.
Wait till she gets to the nursery school.
And discovers that just maybe, because a lot of times the nuns, you know, they ended up they were a little bit of a wild gal to begin with before they ended up in the nunnery. They might actually have some children in the probationary nursery when they get there. You never know. Yes.
Nobody's in the closet.
All right, keep going.
Men eventually conceived the idea that the offering of some part of the body could take the place of the older and complete human sacrifice. Physical mutilation was also considered to be an acceptable substitute. Hair, nails, blood, and even fingers and toes were sacrificed. The later and well-nigh universal ancient rite of circumcision was an outgrowth of the cult of partial sacrifice. It was purely sacrificial, no thought of hygiene being attached thereto. Men were circumcised, women had their ears pierced.
Right, so you know, it's not just because you're trying to put those fishing lures in your ears and attract men, right? You're sacrificing the wholeness of your ear by putting a hole in its wholeness, right? And notice we have the exact same parallel, the same thing we went through with cannibalism, where it started with eating the whole body and then it evolved, you know, to parts and special, ever more special parts. Exact same thing repeats itself. Sacrificing the whole body is how you start, and then and you're sacrificing parts, and then the most special parts of the body. Okay. Same evolutionary process that you got to go through again. And just as always, we're progressing in spite of ourselves. There's always practical, you know, issues that are involved in all these things, whether it's hygiene or whatever. Right? And almost always some not recognized fact to the people doing it that's becoming part of the moray system that helps out with the stuff that would have been just directly taught to us by the prince's staff. All kinds of various, you know, not just the hygiene stuff, right? Like I said, but all those different groups of the prince's staff, all those things had to get into the system by an evolutionary process because they weren't put in directly by the prince's staff, whether it's agricultural techniques or whatever it is, you know?
If you're wondering about the ratio of efficiency, right. It's a big ratio.
Yeah, it takes a long time for it to find some way to coincidentally get into the system right through the evolutionary process. But it'll eventually get there, right? Evolution will always accomplish what revelation fails to achieve, right? Just takes a very circuitous and curious route. Okay.
Subsequently, it became the custom to bind fingers together instead of cutting them off. Shaving the head and cutting the hair were likewise forms of religious devotion. The making of eunuchs was at first a modification of the idea of human sacrifice. Nose and lip piercing is still practiced in Africa, and tattooing is an artistic evolution of the earlier crude scarring of the body.
We're talking about temple prostitution stuff. Now for the guys in the room, it's all getting a lot more. eunuchs, yes, okay. Again, think about how the gears are turning. You're going, I could literally remove a finger. Or, if I just bound two fingers together, effectively I've lost a finger. Now I only have four fingers, see? Right, so, the gears turn and you have ever more subtle substitution concepts. Because, again, what's really going on is more. You can think more and more abstractly. Right? And so things get ever more refined, less they don't have to be so literal and direct and... not just ear piercing, see, but nose and lip piercing. Again, it's as we look backward, we don't think of that in the proper way. That's a sacrifice, effectively. In a substitution mode, you look at it. Forward in the evolutionary process instead of looking back. It isn't just about, if I'm going to have something attached to my body, I've got to, somehow have a hole to stick it in, right? It's not just that practical issue, right? When some of us look at it, it's like, now why would I want my lip pierced like that? Doesn't it make that a lot more difficult to eat and stuff? You think about that. Oh, yeah, it's a sacrifice, right? You're sacrificing ease of eating or something, or right? That's the whole point, Or the scarring of the body, you're sacrificing, the quote-unquote perfection, right, of your form, the smoothness of your body. And then they're pointing out, isn't it interesting that in this case, art imitates life? All right? That eventually when you stop the scarring thing as a sacrifice, you had art imitating that life with tattooing.
They say a lot of people, the reason people do, whether it's piercings or tattooing, is more to get recognized today than it is a sacrifice. It's more to be able to.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that? Oh, because I get noticed.
Yeah. See, we all know how we can look back, and rationalize what we have in front of us. But they're trying to remind you, how did piercing get started in the first place so that you could rationalize it like you do now? See? And that's what they're trying to remind you. It got started with a sacrifice concept.
Right.
Okay. There's always that deeper question. It's not, there is to go beyond kind of the science of it, how you're rationalizing it right now, to go to the why of it, the philosophic question is, why is there piercing in the first place? Not how should I rationalize it? Okay. And the book is always trying to get you beyond the science of something, right, to the philosophy, the why question, so that you can begin to understand, you can begin to strike step with the flow of phenomena, rather than just getting stuck on a current how of facts in front of you, okay, and inexorably existentializing that, and believing that there's some sort of perfection in it or something, okay? to see it for what it is, as part of a process, and to temper your tendency to existentialize by, if nothing else, reminding yourself of the very crude, savage roots of all this stuff. Maybe I shouldn't get too fixated on this. You know, I remember we talked about that, as important in an evolutionary process as, you know, the bread and wine sacrament is. Okay. But eventually you move through that. I mean, they aren't doing bread and wine, you know, remembrance suppers on the Isle of Paradise. It's not there. Okay. You got to let it be part of an evolutionary process so you don't existentialize it and keep it properly tempered like that by just reminding it all goes. It all goes back to sacrifice, which goes back to cannibalism, you know, which goes back, okay.
Of course,
that wine. Oh, yeah. All right, let's keep going here.
The custom of sacrifice eventually became associated as a result of advancing teachings with the idea of the covenant. At last, the gods were conceived of and entering into real agreements with man, and this was a major step in the stabilization of religion. Law, a covenant, takes the place of luck, fear, and superstition.
See, again, we're evolving towards law and territorial states. Yeah, even if it's all religiousized to begin with covenants and stuff like that, right? It's a beginning. And that whole bit of trying to move away from the sort of infinitely fickle spirits, right, to a stable God, right, which eventually can be the proper existential father who is literally absolutely changeless. Okay, you can't just do that one step. There has to be a process that evolves you to recognizing that that seems appropriate. That makes sense to me. So again, they have all of these strong statements. At last, right, the gods are conceived of as entering into real agreements. Just the fact, like I said, you're getting towards the changelessness of eternity, hence the word real there. Okay. So it's no one is thinking about this very consciously, but we're being progressed in spite of ourselves.
Okay. Man could never even dream of entering into a contract with deity until his concept of God had advanced to the level whereon the universe controllers were envisioned as dependable. And man's early idea of God was so anthropomorphic that he was unable to conceive of a dependable deity until he himself became relatively dependable, moral, and ethical.
Ah, see, look at how they're flipping it around. See, taking it all the way. See, that's the... Like I said, it's a very interesting thing. Self-respect is developing. Like I was saying, way back at the beginning here, that you're starting to recognize that that through choice you can be significant, and you're even beginning to sense. Then it's like, well, where did my ability to stand apart from being buffeted about by time, where does that come from? It must come from a God that is the essence of that changelessness. And if I adopt that, I can stand above the vicissitudes of time more, and I can begin to have something that I should call character. Right? That internal character then manifests out. That moral character manifests out as an ethical behavior in my engagement with others. And so, like I said, that's one of the key things in this. Throughout all of this curious notions, you're starting with a very low sense of self and you're lifting that up. That's step one, to get it lifted up. Then the next step is to know when you've lifted it to its appropriate height and to not lift it any further. Yeah. To get it up to self-respect, but don't take it up to self-esteem or even worse, right? Self-admiration. But one step at a time. First we've got to get us up to some sense that we're, that's less nihilistic.
Now that's quite a move in evolution.
Yeah.
That's significant.
But we lost it in almost the snap of a finger. You know, now children are, so many children are being raised with a very nihilistic philosophy. They just have no self-respect and sometimes act out in extremely nihilistic fashions, to try to prove that there's no purpose, let's just kill everyone, or whatever, randomly. Yeah.
It's not all.
We're fighting with it again. These issues and it's not all over the world. It's, where is it going to be most? In the best genetic parts of the world. The most progressive genetics is going to be most susceptible to overplaying stuff, right? It takes a personal phenomenon to go nihilistic, right? The more animalistic you are, the less tendency there's going to be, right? The more spiritualized you are, the more you'll use guns nihilistically, rather than just treating them matter-of-factly.
But Chris, guns don't kill people.
Right? Like I said, using guns, or whatever. If you don't have a gun, you use a stick of dynamite. Okay, but you're going to be nihilistic. You're going to be aggressive. You're going to bring this religious energy into what you do with material phenomena, be they guns or dynamite or whatever. Okay, and so don't be surprised if other places in the world don't have as much problem as we do. You have to get as spiritual as you are on Gerasim in order to have the kind of problem that's called the Lucifer Rebellion. Mm-hmm. You can't have that, in the heart of New Guinea. Okay, that doesn't generate the Lucifer Rebellion.
Right?
That's the thing we have to remember here. To those whom much is given is much expected. Right? If you're going to be more genetically spiritual, then you have to recognize you're more likely to be very problematic if you don't control yourself.
You look at what this is and where it was placed. There's the data point.
Right. Right. People are trying to figure out why is it going to hell in a handbasket so fast in the United States compared to other, say, like Western countries? Like, well, which country is the leading edge? Okay. Okay.
But the idea of making a covenant with the gods did finally arrive. Evolutionary man eventually acquired such moral dignity that he dared to bargain with his gods. And so the business of offering sacrifices gradually developed into the game of man's philosophic bargaining with God. And all this represented a new device for insuring against bad luck, or, rather, an enhanced technique for the more definite purchase of prosperity. Do not entertain the mistaken idea that these early sacrifices were a free gift to the gods, a spontaneous offering of gratitude or thanksgiving. They were not expressions of true worship.
Remember, that's hearkening back. Remember how I told you that both were in play? Early in the evolution of religion, there existed two conceptions of the sacrifice, the idea of the gift sacrifice, which connoted the attitude of thanksgiving, and the debt sacrifice, which embraced the idea of redemption. Remember, they told you that way back here at the beginning, the origins of sacrifice. And remember, and I told you, but which takes off? Not the positive one.
Redemption.
Right. It's the negative one, the debt sacrifice. And as they're pointing out here, don't think that what we're talking about is the gift sacrifice here. This is the death sacrifice. It's in the redemption section, after all. Okay. Okay, so, but on the positive side, they had to use the word philosophic to talk about what was going on. Hey, that's a step forward. Right? Man's philosophic bargaining with God. Right?
Put some flowers in there with the thorn.
Okay. Well, we'll take what we can get here. But also, this is right where we were feeling some tension a minute ago. Right? The more definite purchase of prosperity. Right? And if you don't do it with some sort of literal sacrifice thing, you're going to do it with praying. You're going to seek prosperity through praying. Oh, that's what the next sentence is about.
Primitive forms of prayer were nothing more nor less than bargaining with the spirits, an argument with the gods. It was a kind of bartering in which pleading and persuasion were substituted for something more tangible and costly. The developing commerce of the races had inculcated the spirit of trade and had developed the shrewdness of barter. And now these traits began to appear in man's worship methods. And as some men were better traders than others, so some were regarded as better prayers than others. The prayer of a just man was held in high esteem. A just man was one who had paid all accounts to the spirits, had fully discharged every ritual obligation to the gods.
So if he asked something of the gods, they must obey. There's no debt there, right? You know, if the gods don't respond, they'll be in debt. Heaven forbid. Okay. Right. So again, it's, you know, they put you a large paragraph there break so you could take a deep breath and face the fact that they just mentioned this is all about purchasing prosperity, right? Be it health or wealth or life, right? And that literally it goes from literal sacrifice, even, you know, substitution sacrifice notions, to prayer, because you're playing off of what you've developed economically. Trade and barter. Like, oh, that's really significant. That is will be effective with God too. Let me pray for my prosperity. It's just like human sacrifice. I'll get it. See, like I said, this is very harsh. Like I said, you need to take a deep breath, right? Like I said, if we're gonna figure out where a prayer is appropriate, first we've got to face the fact of how inappropriate our thoughts are in general about prayer. Right? Right? Prayer is one of the four indispensables of advancing civilization, but not what you think of when you hear the word prayer. You know, that prayer that's indispensable to advancing civilization has absolutely nothing to do with what you've ever thought about. We got to figure out what that word is referring to, one of those four indispensables. It's not this stuff that's coming out of sacrifice and material pleasantness desire.
There's about 20 examples in the last paper.
Okay.
Easy stuff for, yeah. As you're saying.
Yeah.
Totally different of what
right.
Normally.
You know, it's not, you know, the effectiveness, effective in what sense? Effective in materially or effective spiritually? All right, let's see if we can finish up here.
Early prayer was hardly worship. It was a bargaining petition for health, wealth, and life. And in many respects, prayers have not much changed with the passing of the ages. They are still read out of books, recited formally, and written out for emplacement on wheels and for hanging on trees, where the blowing of the winds will save man the trouble of expending his own breath.
Yeah. Not only is it a superstitious notion, but we're lazy on top of it.
little indolence.
But you know, no, that's not lazy. Remember, it's the breath of life. I mean, the winds are the breath of God. You're putting it right into the breath of, yeah, you can rationalize this. Okay. But you know, again, I'm not being harsh. I'm trying to just point out that they're being direct. Early prayer was hardly worship. In other words, it's not the prayer that the revelators are talking about is prayer that leads to thanksgiving, that leads to worship. This is prayer that's not with the thanksgiving sacrifice. This is prayer that's with the debt sacrifice. Yeah. Okay? Yeah. It's in the opposite direction, basically. Okay? It's not the prayer that leads up through thanksgiving to worship. Right? Early prayer was hardly worship. It was a bargaining petition for health, wealth, and life. Yeah. Take a deep breath and look at yourself. Look at your prayer life. Right? Health, wealth, and life. Right? And in many respects, prayers have not much changed with the passing of the ages. Okay? This is not me trying to impose my ideology on anyone. It's always most difficult when we get to prayer. Right? That's one of your most cherished things. Okay? And it's not that prayer can't be cherished, but it needs to be genuine prayer. Don't take what happens naturally that leads through sacrifice and all that stuff and falsely exalt that. Okay? You need to turn 180 degrees and have prayer born again. Okay? A prayer that leads to self-forgetting. Okay? A kind of prayer that leads you to turning your back on yourself instead of turning your face ever more definitively to yourself. Health, wealth, and life. Right? A prayer that leads to looking at eternity instead of a prayer that leads to looking at time. Health, wealth, and life. Yeah, it's all time stuff. And time's not a reality. Okay?
Well, there is a difference in praying for yourself, health, wealth, and for others.
That's an evolutionary step, right? But again,
itself is beginning. The prayer was an evolutionary step too.
Right. I mean, see again, right? But that's
it. Talking to God and saying, "Okay,
if I can't pray about my temporal self, I can improve that by praying for that person's temporal self." Came in eventually, though, I can abstract away, right? Again, it's an evolutionary process, but we're just trying to challenge ourselves to this higher thing. And again, we'll talk about this endlessly when we talk. We have a whole chat, a whole paper on prayer. Okay, but they're trying to prime the pump here, so it isn't so shocking when we try to face this directly. It is a challenge to our sensibilities. All of religion is predicated on prayer. And it seems like you're trying to rip away religion itself if you start challenging the definition of prayer.
Or more than ripping it away with social justice.
Right. Yeah, just the book is rugged. The book is rugged. Okay. Well, we'll keep moving on here with sacrifices. You see the next time. We've got to get to the fullness of the atonement doctrine.
Is that when we get to the at-one-ment doctrine?
Yeah, the at-one-ment doctrine, yes. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.